Welcome to the East County Magazine live radio show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio representing the public interest, not special interest. Broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso on KNSJ 89.1 FM, your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. I'm here today with John Mattis, an award-winning investigative reporter. He's got a site called The Investigative Guy, and he's also with MuchBetterChoices.com. John, tell us a little bit about some of the awards that you've won for your reporting through the years.
Over the years, I've exposed mortgage fraud, I've exposed used car scams, I've exposed the issue of water for people in Lakeside and where that water was going and where it was coming from. Those are some of the issues. They've been consumer issues across a broad range of areas that I've won awards for as a reporter. And now I'm, as a consumer advocate, trying to take on the issue.
You've won an Emmys, I understand.
A number of Emmys, a Murrow, and a Golden Mike Award for some of the exposés I've done regarding corruption here in San Diego County.
And now you're taking on SDG&E. Tell us about the petition that you have started to try to get some money back for the ratepayers.
It's rather simple. What happened is, we all know the history of what happened at San Onofre. The utilities conspired with Mitsubishi to put in repairs and not tell the NRC fully what was going
on. Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
And Senator Boxer exposed that in a letter and found that there was an attempt to cover up what really had been going on there. Well, sadly, after 2 years, there was leaks, and they had to shut the plant down. Now, let's fast forward to the present. The operators of the plant, the utility, is now telling the public and regulators that, in fact, they want us, the consumers, to pay for their mistakes. Now, their mistakes aren't minor. It's not $20 here or there. It's a minimum $600 million mistake.
More than half a billion dollars that SDG&E wants the ratepayers instead of its shareholders to pay for. Now, you have an idea that there's a much better choice out there. Tell us what that is and what you're trying to do about it.
We have a website called MuchBetterChoices.com, and we've started a simple petition. It says, we don't want to pay for your mistakes at San Onofre. And this is directed at SDG&E, and we're asking all of our elected officials to take a stand and intervene to protect us, the ratepayers. We know that there are going to be massive rate increases due to their mistakes at SDG&E, and the petition specifically directs our elected representatives to intervene with the Public Utilities Commission and stand on our behalf. When's the last time you heard a public official mention the words consumer protection? Isn't it about time they start protecting us? This isn't an issue for Democrats, Republicans. This is an issue for taxpayers. This is an issue for all of us.
I understand that you're getting quite a few signatures already and that it's from people in all different political parties.
It's an issue that cuts across all parties. Think about accountability. We're asked to be accountable in our personal behavior. We expect the same from the corporation. We're taught as small children that we should clean up our own messes. That's all I'm asking them to do. Clean up your mess. Don't bill me for your mistakes at SDG&E. And what we're hoping that people will do is sign this petition, share it with their neighbors, go online to MuchBetterChoices.com, sign it, hand it to your neighbors so that we can tell the politicians here in San Diego County that we expect them to protect us, not the utility.
Now, I understand that you are sending this, the petition is going automatically to the chairman of the Board of Supervisors, the mayor of San Diego, the city attorney, and that afterwards you plan to also hand deliver copies to some of our East County political officials. Is that correct?
We're going to take it to every elected body here in San Diego County and even further north because the issue cuts across all geographic boundaries. It's an issue of, shouldn't cities protect themselves? They buy electricity. Shouldn't cities protect us? And it isn't just San Diego. It isn't just Chula Vista. It's every single city. And all the people here in San Diego County, we've gotten those letters from SDG&E. They want more money from us, and they haven't even yet billed us, they claim, for
the mistakes. They're talking about a 9 to 11% increase, and I believe that does not even include this $500 million or more for the repairs at San Onofre. So we're talking another increase on top of that?
It's going to go on. And the critical point is that we can intervene. There is a process at the Public Utilities Commission. They're going to decide whether we consumers are going to pay for the mistakes or the shareholders. Why should ratepayers pay for the mistakes of corporate executives?
Now, shareholders, the company can certainly afford this. SDG&E, I understand, had record profits last year. Is that correct?
Of course. They can afford it. This is something that is based on corporate risk. They took the risk. They screwed up. Now they're asking us to pay. I say no, thank you.
And that seems to be a pattern with SDG&E, certainly with the wildfires, where the PUC found that they were responsible for causing some of the 2007 wildfires, and yet SDG&E was trying to get the PUC to let it make ratepayers pay for that as well. The PUC so far said no to that offer, and now you're wanting them to say no to this one as well.
Think about a small business. If a small business makes a mistake, they can't go to their customer and say, oh, by the way, can you pay for the mistakes I made last year? Of course not. Why does this company think that they can get away with it? Is it just because they're so big? Is it just because they're so powerful? Is it just because they think they control the Public Utilities Commission? I say no.
Thank you very much, John, for joining us here today. And again, you can find that petition online at www.muchbetterchoices.com. And we will also be posting a copy of it at eastcountymagazine.org very soon as well.
Thank you.
This is a breaking news alert live from the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service.
A lawsuit challenging fire parcel fees was heard Friday in Sacramento Superior Court. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association sued the state of California, arguing that fire parcel fees assessed on taxpayers in state responsibility areas, including most of East County, should be considered taxes, not fees. A two-thirds majority vote of the state legislature is required to pass a new tax, though this requirement does not apply to fees. The state argued that the Jarvis Group does not have standing to represent taxpayers in the class action lawsuit, but the judge disagreed, ruling that the Jarvis organization does have legal standing. The state now has 10 days to file a response. The judge has not yet ruled on the merits of the case itself. The fire parcel tax has sparked controversy in East County, where some residents and Supervisor Diane Jacob have argued that rural residents are already paying fees for protection in rural districts and that the fire parcel fee amounts to double taxation. Opponents have also argued that fire protection costs should be spread among all taxpayers and that rural residents are already paying more in brush clearing costs and higher fire insurance. The state has contended that the fire parcel fee is necessary to cover state firefighting costs in an era of budget shortfalls and an increasing number of larger and more severe wildfires. This is Miriam Raftery for KNSJ and East County Magazine. On August 9th, Rising from the Ashes, a fundraiser will be held to help raise money for cleanup costs of the Shrine Camp on Mount Laguna, which was devastated by the Chariot Fire. The Shrine Camp lost 23 buildings in the blaze, including the Shriner's 99-year-old lodge. The Albar Shrine Center in San Diego will host the event from 5 to 11 p.m. in the Red Fez Room at the Albar Shrine Center. The event will include dinner and entertainment. The Shriners, an international organization, provide philanthropic services, including operating 22 hospitals for children. For more information, visit www.albarshrine.org. For KNSJ on Mount Laguna, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member of www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole in the Wall gang and the Gaskell brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past.
The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Summertime is the busiest marriage season. To help with increased demand from all those happy couples, the county clerk's office has added walk-in Wednesdays. If you arrive between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Wednesdays at the county clerk's main office, County Administration Center at 1600 Pacific Coast Highway downtown, you will be issued a marriage license and can be married the same day without making an appointment. Walk-in Wednesdays will continue through September 25th. During the first 3 weeks of Walk-In Wednesdays, the county clerk's office issued 468 marriage licenses and performed 270 wedding ceremonies. Appointments are still required at all other branches of the county clerk. If a couple would like to schedule an appointment at any branch office, including East County, they should call 619-237-0502.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. Pine Valley Days are back again. This annual celebration has been happening for 43 years. The location is the Pine Valley County Park on Old Highway 80. On Friday evening, July 26th, the two-day celebration begins with a deep pit barbecue and dancing under the stars to the Honky Tonk Kings. The fun continues all day Saturday, July 27th, starting with a parade at 9 a.m., including festivities all day. These include kids' activities, a country marketplace with over 25 vendors, a chili cook-off, and Music in the Mountains, a festival of live music all day. Visit www.pinevalleydays.com for details on the festival and the performers. A featured activity this week on Destination East County happens on Wednesday, July 24th. Stroll the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College in the balmy summer evenings with your doggy. Wednesdays from 4 to 7 p.m., now through August 31st, bring along a canine friend on a leash for extra fun. The garden is designed for walking, sitting, browsing, and relaxing among the varied species of plant life. You'll learn lots of tips for water conservation in your yard and garden, as well as ideas for garden arrangements of all kinds. Also at Cuyamaca College in El Cajon at the Performing Arts Center, Young Actors Theater presents Les Miserables. Tickets are on sale for performance dates July 25th through 28th and August 1st through 4th. Check our calendar on East County Magazine for showtimes. The last Thursday night of each month at the Regal on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa is Best Night of Free Comedy. The show starts at 8:30 p.m. Their headliners have been on Comedy Central, The Improv, Gabriel Iglesias' Stand Up Revolution, and have toured with other well-known comedians. The comedy show is only once a month, but each Friday night they have karaoke with K.J. Roman at 9:30 p.m. The City of La Mesa presents Movie Nights Under the Stars on Friday, July 26th at La Mesita Park. The family movie Wreck-It Ralph begins at 8 p.m. with pre-show entertainment at 7:30. Also on July 26th, enjoy Friday nights in downtown El Cajon at the Prescott Promenade. The concert features The Next Generation, a modern bluegrass band, this Friday evening. Dining discounts are offered at local restaurants. Camp with the Stars at William Heiss County Park in Julian on Saturday, July 27th at 8 p.m. Join guest speaker Doug McFarland as he takes you for a celestial journey through the heavens with his star program. After the slideshow, take advantage of the multiple telescopes to view the starry skies of San Diego County. This event is open to all ages. If you plan to spend the day at the park, you can enjoy the 10 miles of hiking, equestrian, and nature walking trails, as well as all 7 days of the week. Pets are allowed as long as they are on a leash. Dos Picos Regional Park in Ramona holds activities every Saturday throughout the day. There must be at least 10 people, good weather, and ranger availability, so please check with them at 760-789-2220 before starting out. The planned activities at the amphitheater include a ranger-led walk and talk, junior rangers, snakes and skins, crafts, earth ball game, and a texture scavenger hunt, all at different times during the day. Saturday night hikes are scheduled for the month of July at 8:45 p.m., so this Saturday night is the last one. Also in Ramona on Saturday night, July 27th, view the family movie Brave at Collier Park starting at dusk. The park has barbecues, picnic tables, playgrounds, a tennis court, and a native plant garden. On Sunday, July 29th, connect with nature during a family discovery walk at Mission Trails Regional Park from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Meet at the Visitor's Center at Mission Trails Regional Park in San Carlos. All of these activities and more are in our calendar and festivals and events section on www.eastcountymagazine.org. That's all for this week. See you around East County.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting today for the Sounds of History segment. My guest today is Brian Harrington. Brian is the author of Campo, the Forgotten Gunfight, and he is also a member of the Hole in the Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers Gunfighters, two Wild West reenactment troops right here in East County. And they are going to be providing live entertainment at our Wild West Fest to benefit East County Magazine's wildfire reporting coming up on August 10th from 4 to 7 at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in Western history.
When I grew up, the Westerns were the biggest thing there was on TV, and I think I was infatuated with the Western heroes. I didn't grow up in California. I grew up on the East Coast. So watching my heroes every Saturday ride by on the silver screen, it's kind of attracted me to it. And all of my life, I've been destined to live the cowboy life, and I'm trying to live it as close as one can today.
When did you get involved in the two Western reenactment groups?
A lot of people probably haven't heard of the Campo gunfight. The Campo gunfight took place December the 4th, 1875, in the little border town of Campo, out along our San Diego-Mexican border. It was a historically significant piece of history in the fact that the Mexican banditos who attacked the town of Campo weren't the typical Mexicans coming across the border from Mexico. These were Californios bandidos that came down from Central and Northern California, whose families had deep roots in California long before the Americans got here.
They were wanted, right, for killing stagecoach drivers.
Originally started out with names like Joaquin Murrieta, who was actually claimed to be a revolutionary. He wanted to take back California from the gringo gold miner invaders who were invaded their country. And for good reason. The American miners didn't treat the citizens of California very well in them days. And they were pushed out because of the large numbers of miners greatly outnumbered the indigenous population and the Mexican population of California today.
So when the heat was on these guys, there was a bounty on their heads, they fled south of the border, and they came up with a plan to finance their way to go down and rob the gold trains in Mexico City, I understand.
Yeah.
What was that plan?
There was. The posses were chasing them all over California, Central and Northern California, and they realized that they were going to be caught eventually. So they made their way into Tecate to get the posses off of their trail. And while down there, they decided that they would rob the town of Campo, which is just on the American side of the border. Their plan was basically to ride into town, take over the town, kill anyone who got in their way, load up everything of value that they could possibly want in wagons, and haul it back across the border.
Wow, so it was a very bold, daring plan, but one thing went wrong. They were down there talking about this in the cantina south of the border in Tecate, and then what happened?
That's right. While they were making their plans in the Tecate cantina, they were overheard by a Mexican fellow who knew the Gaskill brothers who owned the town of Campo. The brothers Lumen and his brother Silas Gaskill.
And these guys were sharpshooters, correct?
Yes, they were. They were both extremely good marksmen. In fact, Silas Gaskill, during the gold rush, he came west at the age of 21 in 1850, and he found it very difficult to get rich panning for gold in the cold streams, and very few of the miners did get rich panning. But one day, a rancher came in who had a grizzly bear killing his cattle. His cattle were very expensive. Beef was very, very high priced during the gold rush era. So he offered $50 for anyone who could shoot that grizzly bear and get rid of it. And Silas took him up on it. And 2 days later, he came back with a dead grizzly bear. And he got his $50 reward for it. And the miner said, "Silas, what are you going to do with that bear?" Silas said, "I don't know." And they said, "Well, we'll buy it off of you for $50. We'll eat it. That's a lot cheaper than eating beef." So Silas got the idea that hunting for the mining camps would be much more lucrative than panning in the cold streams. And he was right, as in by his own estimation in the interviews conducted with him up until his death in 1914, Silas had stated by his own reckoning he had shot 302 bears in Northern
wow.
California.
So these banditos were up against a pretty fearsome force when they
came
up here.
They had no idea. These were not the normal pushover storekeepers they were used to robbing up in central Northern California. Mm-hmm. And they committed a lot of daring daylight robberies of entire towns up there.
So when the Gaskill brothers found out what was planned, what did they do? I understand they first tried to contact the San Diego sheriff for help.
Yes, San Diego had a telegraph office in Campo. It was the Army Military Telegraph from Fort Yuma to San Diego. So word was able to travel very quickly on the telegraph lines. And they telegraphed for the sheriff when they got word that the banditos were formulating plans down to Tecate to come across the border and rob Campo. But the sheriff had no authority on the other side of the line. It being still more or less rumors, he felt that he didn't have enough to go on to send a posse out to Campo.
So Campo was on its own.
Campo was on its own.
So yes. What happened?
8 days had gone by since the Gaskills had actually learned about the banditos being down in Tecate. And for 2 days, they had all the area ranchers ride into town, and they protected the town. They hid up in the rock. And if the banditos had rode into Campo during them 2 days, they wouldn't have stood a chance. But winter was coming on, and the ranchers, they had ranches to take care of, and they had to get ready and feed put away for winter and cattle rounded up. And so they couldn't stay in Campo and guard the town forever. So the Gaskills, knowing this, said, "Well, you know, we'll take care of ourselves. They're not here yet." Then they got word that Chavez, the bandit's leader, was killed down near Yuma, Arizona, and then they totally put it to rest. They said, "Well, with Chavez dead, these banditos probably aren't bold enough to come to Campo now."
Whoops, so, big mistake.
But it was a big mistake. The bandito second-in-command, Cruz Lopez, took over the gang. And 8 days later, on December the 4th, they rode into Campo at 10:30 in the morning.
And what happened when they showed up at the store?
The plan was to send 3 men into the store and robbed the storekeeper, which was Lumen Gaskill, the youngest brother of the Gaskills. The other 3 banditos, there were 6 in all, were going to go to the blacksmith shop and shoot the blacksmith and get him out of the way. Well, they attempted to shoot the blacksmith, and they only wounded Silas in the arm. Silas got a double-barrel shotgun and killed one of the banditos outright and severely wounded another one. Then the bandits in the store attacked the storekeeper, and they severely wounded Lumen Gaskill with a shot point blank. Bullet went through his lung, came out his back. The bandits thought he was dead, left him on the floor for dead, robbed the store and went outside. That's when a Frenchman rode into town who worked on a sheep ranch nearby, and he realized the town was under attack, so he took out his pistol and started shooting at the bandits. And he wounded the bandit leader in the neck severely. In fact, he died of his wounds. But the other bandits riddled the Frenchman, and he died of his wounds. But Lumen Gaskell, the storekeeper, who was left for dead on the floor, he came to during the middle of the fracas,
wow,
got a double-barreled shotgun, come out, and wounded two of the bandits very severely. In the Campo gunfight, five out of the six bandits that rode into Campo died, and the sheep herder who came into town, two,
now, this
six.
Was very historic. The Campo gunfight actually lasted longer and resulted in more people dying than the famous shootout at the OK Corral.
Yes, that's true. The OK Corral, on its own, was a very famous and historical Western gunfight, and it had different factions that in play that were fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. But the Campo gunfight was really very, very significant in the history of California, as far as these Californios bandidos have been raiding and killing Californians for years, mm-hmm, since 1849. But that day, December the 4th, 1875, in Campo, was the last time that they ever attacked any of the communities in California, and it put an end to the reign of the bold and boisterous outlaws, highwaymen, and bandidos who rode the trails of California through the mountains and canyons, deserts and valleys of the great state of California.
That is an amazing story, and actually, it didn't end there. I understand some of these guys got away, and some of them were rounded up and put in a makeshift jail.
Actually, there was only one bandido outright killed in the streets of Campo, but two others were very severely wounded, and they were found hiding in some bushes and rocks on the outside of town, and they were taken into custody. But the next day, they were found hanging at the famous Campo hanging tree, dead, using the very same rope that the bandit leader, Cruz Lopez, had asked to see when he stepped into the store.
Fascinating. Now, you have written the book. Tell us a little bit about what it was like researching that. Did you track down and interview people who remembered this or were descendants of this, knew some of the characters involved?
The research took years, and that's not because I just sat down and did nothing but research. That's because I would pick out a part of the story, track it down, track down people, find out as much as I could. Then I would set that aside, analyze it for a while, and then come to another part of the story. So, and it took me to places like Lone Pine, Independence, Yuma, San Diego Historical Society had lots of good stuff, of course, on the Campo gunfight. The Mountain Empire Historical Society in Campo.
Where can people find your book online?
My book is available on Amazon and on Kindle.
Campo the Forgotten Gunfight.
Campo the Forgotten Gunfight by Brian Harrington can be bought in Campo at the Stone Store Museum.
You've done more than just write about this. At some point, you became involved yourself as a Western reenactor. There's two different groups, the Gaskell Brothers Gunfighters, mm-hmm, and then the other group you're involved in is the Hole in the Wall Gang. Can you tell us a little bit about that group and how they got started?
Well, this all really started with joining the reenactment group, the Gaskell Brothers Gunfighters, out in Campo. In fact, I was looking for a sort of a group to get involved with. It was in the Western historical thing. And I'd heard about the Campo gunfighting. And somebody said, well, call this number and go out and see. Well, I went out, and immediately I got cast as a bandido in the next reenactment.
So, as a fan of
that
Western
was
22 history,
years
this must be
ago.
Really sort of living out the fantasy, isn't it?
Yes, so and it's been a ball. I love history. I love researching history as much as I like writing about it. And one thing just led to another. First, I'm in the Gaskell Gunfighters, and I instantly realized this story was big. It had never been a novel written about it or a movie done on it. I called it Campo the Forgotten Gunfight because kind of Western historians kind of overlooked this one, which was good for me because I was the one to be able to bring it out and present it in the way I did. And one thing left to another. And over the years, doing reenactments and with the Gaskell Gunfighters, finally, I got the opportunity to become skit director for the Hole in the Wall Gang out at Lakeside. The Hole in the Wall Gang is a nonprofit organization, and we do stuff that benefits equestrian-type activities, and that's usually everything we do is around that. You will see us riding most of the San Diego County parades, and we have been for years. The Hole in the Wall Gang's been around since the late 1940s. In fact, we were presented with an award last year from the Mother Goose Parade Association as being the longest-riding equestrian group in their history. In fact, they don't even know how long we've been riding at the Mother Goose Parade, and we don't know how long we've been riding. That's how long it's been going on.
Wow. And they do humorous skits about the Old West. Very entertaining.
Yes.
And you'll be able to see both of these groups doing some skits for us out at the Wild West Fest in Descanso on August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. Descanso Junction is rolling out barbecue tri-tip, so we're going to have some great food and great entertainment for everyone. All to benefit East County Magazine's wildfire reporting and our Viejas wildfire and emergency alerts.
We're looking very forward to your event. And yes, it's going to be some Wild West entertainment and comedy, and it's appropriate for all ages, and we'd love to see you there.
The tickets are $15 if you buy them in advance before the end of July. You can get them on our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org, or if you show up at the door, it's $20 at the door. And Brian, thank you very much for coming out today and sharing that colorful bit of Wild West history. You can also come out and see the entire Campo gunfight recreated on August 24th.
Yes, we will be doing the reenactment of the Campo gunfight at the Golden Acorn out near Boulevard. It's a free show. There's also going to be a barbecue cook-off there, so it's going to be a lot of fun. Free show, got grandstands, good seating, and it's going to be good time.
Very good. Brian Harrington, author of The Great Campo Gunfight, is now going to recite a poem for us about this colorful, forgotten chapter out of East County's history.
Yes, this is a poem about the Campo Gunfight that took place December the 4th, 1875, out in Campo, and this is pretty much exactly the way it happened. It was on a clear Saturday. It was under December skies when five riders rode out to Campo with the sunshine in their eyes. These men were desperados, men who lived by the gun. They'd kill you for your money. They'd kill you for their fun. Back then, Campo was only a small store, hotel, and telegraph. Why, to rob this town would be so easy? All the bandits, did they laugh? And under their sombreros, murder was on each and every mind. They were on their way to Campo to have a feast, but it was on death that most of them would dine. Because you see, their menus, they had been changed, but the bandits still got their fill of buckshot from the shotguns of Lumen and Silas Gaskill. You see, there were six bandits in Campo that day, 'cause one was sent on to scout ahead. But when this battle was over, five were dying or already dead. And a neighbor's ranch hand, who had heard the shots and came riding into town fast, only to be mortally wounded by a bandit's six-gun blast. Today, some say in Campo that gunshots can still be heard upon the breeze. Some say that hanging bodies can still be seen twisting in Campo's trees. You see, two of the bandits were lynched by ranchers who came to see that justice was done. Today, this may shock you all, but that is how the West was won.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past. The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lanes hold yours, and that's a very good sign. That she don't see, won't see in the good old summer time.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Over the weekend, more than 1,000 federal, state, and local law enforcement officers conducted Operation Allied Shield, resulting in nearly 400 arrests, including 34 gang members. The operation included parole and probation checks, traffic stops, and serving search and arrest warrants to locate and arrest gang offenders. Command posts were established in Spring Valley, San Diego, and Vista. The actions resulted in 79 drug seizures, including marijuana, cocaine, heroin, crystal methamphetamine, and more. Funding for the operation was provided by a $5.5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Reporting for KNSJ and East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Lynn Manyfires bringing you the Tribal Beat, covering the news for and about our region's Native American communities. Today's guest on Tribal Beat is Richard Carrico. Richard is a longtime resident of San Diego, and he's lectured for the last 25 years at the Department of American Indian Studies at San Diego State. And he's an adjunct professor at City College, where he teaches anthropology. He has a master's in history and a bachelor's in history and anthropology. His primary research includes the Kumeyaay tribes of San Diego County and Baja, Mexico. He has served as Native American coordinator and principal investigator for survey and evaluation of more than 30,000 acres of Indian trust lands, as well as serving as project director for cultural resources of five Indian tribes. Along with writing more than 30 publications and professional journals, Richard is the author of numerous books, including Strangers in a Stolen Land, The Indians of San Diego County, From Prehistory to the New Deal, and he's currently working on a new book. Richard, I'm honored to have you join me today. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Well, hello, Lynn. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. I'd like to talk a bit about both your books, the new one as well as the most recent one, Strangers in a Stolen Land. Can you share a little bit about both books and your inspiration for writing them?
Sure. I wrote Strangers in a Stolen Land. It started actually back in the 1980s and into the 1990s because there was no one book that a student or a layperson, and I made it very much toward a layperson, could pick up and understand that Native American people had been here for 12,000 years at least, and that at one time there were 80 villages throughout San Diego County and 20,000 Native Americans living here, and then how all that changed when the Europeans came in, first the Spaniards, Mexicans, and later Americans. And I also wanted a book that had a more of an Indian voice in it. I've spent a lot of time interviewing elders and doing archaeology, and I wanted to combine that dirt side of it, that's from-the-ground archaeology, with the voice of some of the elders, Leroy Elliott and Jane Dumas, and some of those people here from the back country, frankly. So that was the impetus, and I had written several articles, and people would come to me and say, well, you've kind of teased us with a little candy here. We want the main course now. What's the rest of this? And so that's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. And so the book goes from 12,000 years ago, which is the earliest dates we have for San Diego County, approximately up to 1938. And I intentionally stopped in 1938 after the New Deal and after the removal of the Capitan Grande Indians to Viejas and Barona, because that's my strength, that's my time period. And then after that, that's another book that might happen in the future.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
From your perspective, what changes have you seen in San Diego's tribal communities in the last 30 years?
I've seen enormous changes. When I used to lecture 30 years ago, if you were in my class 30 years ago, I would say that poverty on the average reservation in San Diego was 48 to 50% below the poverty line, that unemployment was 38 to 40%, that fetal alcohol syndrome was a major problem, and that women's groups and the Marine Corps and Salvation Army were taking turkeys and dinners up to the Indians on the reservations and that whole outreach program. And what's happened with gaming, because of gaming, but not entirely, but because of finances, because of money, is I've seen the tribes now pull themselves up. Most of them have done a very good job. They've had very good leaders like Anthony Pico and Danny Tucker and folks who are very strong, almost traditional leaders, and they've pulled themselves up. And while using the federal government based on some things we can talk about and the county, but basically on their own. And what I've seen is now they're revitalizing their languages. And so while the Kumeyaay language was taking a serious dip by 20 years ago and very few people were speaking it except for some elders, now it's being taught at Cuyamaca College. It's being taught at Verona.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Stan Rodriguez and Raul Chrisman from Viejas have put together classes now, and you can actually take a class in Kumeyaay, and it goes on and on and on, beginning, middle, and advanced. I've seen the ability to bring people up from Pai Pai territory and Tipai territory in Baja California, native people, and they work with the tribes up here and talk about language and basket making and pottery. So it's truly been a revitalization, and watching that younger generation realize that what their grandmother told them was important, and knowing a Kumeyaay word for tree or for acorn is part of your culture, because language is culture, and watching little six-year-old kids speak an entire sentence in Kumeyaay. That wouldn't have happened nearly as often 20, 30 years ago. And then just the sense of pride, of tribalness, of being a nation of people, not just a band of people.
As you just mentioned, and we had spoken about it earlier, you're passionate about the revitalization of the Kumeyaay language and culture. You've just mentioned a few things of how you see that's happening. What else? How else do you see that happening in the community?
I see it happening in most of the major reservations now have also formed a group called the Circle of Elders, or somehow to honor the elder. And so they have lunches for them. They take them on field trips. And again, there's that whole reaching out to both sides, the very young and the very old, not one or the other. I see it in the youth are playing a role because they're coming to a project I've been working on. They come to the elder and say, okay, you're being tape recorded and we're hearing you talk about place names like Tecate is actually a Kumeyaay word.
Really?
Tijuana is an Indian word. It's not Spanish. Tijuana means swept clean from the beach, swept clean.
Oh.
Tecate means it's a knife, essentially. So you're telling granddad's recording this with you and you're hearing these, but what we want is we want to see an internet. We want to see it on video. We want to see something alive because they're a generation that wants movement. And frankly, like most younger children, have a shorter attention span. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing that whole movement of the very young and the older people blending together to form something that in 5 or 6 years will be huge. There's fiestas now held about native foods. Going back and using native foods, there's actually a couple cookbooks out.
Great.
One out of Heyday Press out of San Francisco or out of Berkeley, and there's recipes from San Diego County in there of using native products. Yeah.
That is awesome.
So again, it's in the kitchen, it's on the internet, it's back the revitalization of language. There's a Kumeyaay mapping site that you can go to on the internet, and right now it just gives you the name of what does Poway mean? It's not Poway. Poway. What does Poway mean? Well, it means convergence or a point where two things meet, and you click on it and you find that out. And what we're doing now is interviewing and recording elders saying these Kumeyaay words so that when you click on Tecate or you click on Poway, you'll hear a native speaker say it then, and then a picture will come up. It's out there. People think all this culture got completely lost, and unfortunately anthropologists kind of fed into that by saying 50 years ago, I'm interviewing the last of the. So anthropologists almost killed them off, in press at least. But meanwhile, the elders are sitting back there going, no, he wasn't the last one. And we just didn't tell you that story because we didn't want to share it with you. Because in the Spanish period, we would be killed.
That's very
telling
common
that story.
With a lot of tribes, actually.
It is.
Yeah.
So it went underground. So I almost see it like an underground river that's now coming back up, and there's springs all over the place, and they're bubbling out, and people are drinking from those springs, and they're getting knowledge. And so to me, as a historian and an anthropologist, it's been a phenomenal process watching that. But as a person versus the academic side, it's been even more phenomenal to go on a reservation and hear people talking Kumeyaay over lunch. That would not have happened much 30 years ago.
For you, that must be a rewarding experience, huh?
It is, and it just feeds into my passion, of course. It's like, and I'm so happy to have been a part of it, not to have been instrumental in any way, because I'm not, but to just have been a part of like a leaf floating along on this amazing river that's going great places. It's just so cool.
And building stronger.
Yep.
Finally, with all the work you've done in our native communities with regards to sacred sites, what's your personal opinion of the wind energy projects on the various reservations?
I put wind energy into all the categories of, let's say, a large casino, a wind energy project, fracking up in the northern tier, you know, whatever thing's going on that's going to change the land. I always put it in the context of, first of all, I have to look at it from, is it serving the Native American community? So if it's on a reservation, I have to assume that the tribal council and maybe the general council voted on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so are they going to get economic revenue out of it? In some cases, are they going to get power that they wouldn't have had on the reservation before? Because there mm-hmm. are still some reservations mm-hmm. throughout the state that don't have electricity. And then you have to balance that off. That's the pragmatic side, is does it serve a practical purpose with, is it actually endangering sacred sites? And then that's when it gets touchy, because they would have been required under federal law, all tribes are required on trust land to do environmental studies.
Right.
People think they don't have to do any environmental studies because it's exempt from the county. That's not true.
They just have
to take it to the federal level. So assuming that they did their work and assuming that they hired good anthropologists and archaeologists, I would like to believe that those wind turbines did not get sited on a known sacred site. Having said that, for many Kumeyaay, as many Native Americans throughout America, the land itself is sacred. The viewshed is sacred. And so if you drive past Campo today or La Posta, Manzanita area, and you see those giant turbines, and now they're building some south of the border as well, a lot of them, I've certainly talked to elders who have said, yes, they did not put them on top of a sacred site, but they've impacted the sacred landscape. That as a child growing up, I could walk out of my house and see the hills and think about my grandfather's stories. When I walk out now, I see wind turbines. I hear wind turbines. I see dead birds on the ground. And so for some people, it's the wrong thing to do. But I guess I always try to come back to Native Americans are no different at some level than any other human. There's always going to be a disparity of thought between the pragmatic side, the energy side. There's always going to be, should we build a shopping center near Gettysburg or not? Does that defame Gettysburg? Do we do wind turbines on Indian land? Do we put a road across a reservation? So at what point are you bringing the tribe along versus at what point are you hurting them for generations to come by an action you want to do now?
That's a common issue, the traditionals versus the progressives on all the reservations across the country. This is definitely a complicated issue in a lot of areas. As a matter of fact, I'd like to invite you to come back next week and speak more about maybe some political views, as far as you had mentioned something about, you know, how Reagan, how Bill Clinton, how Obama is affecting the tribes even locally here. Would you be willing to join us again?
I'd be glad to do that, because that's a whole other issue, but it has roots that go back hundreds of years with the federal government. Absolutely. I'd be glad to, Lynn.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank my guest, Richard Carrico, for sharing his rich knowledge of the tribes here in San Diego. And I'd like to invite him back to maybe talk to us again next month if in his busy schedule. And I know he is busy. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Tribal Beat. If you have a story you would like to hear more about or a person of interest in the community, please contact me at tribalbeat@eastcountymagazine.org. That's tribalbeat@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Welcome to Vines and Wines with your host, Greg Manis of the Manis Vineyards Estate.
Today we're going to introduce you to Terry and Michael, and they are the owners of the Ramona Ranch Winery. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Tell me a little bit about yourselves.
Well, Mike and I are both from a small town on the Oregon coast. Ramona appealed to us because of its rural nature, open spaces, and the opportunity to have horses and farm, all of which we're lucky to do.
Well, it's beautiful up here, I can tell you that much. How did you guys actually get started?
Well, we moved up to Ramona in 2004, and in 2005 we saw an invitation to attend a meeting of the Ramona Valley Vineyard Association. These meetings were held in people's homes, and we went, met a great group of people, and decided that it seemed like something we were interested in. We were invited to come and help out at harvest, and we were hooked.
Nice. And you started making your first wines that year? How did that work?
Well, we were paid for our labor, so to say, with 100 pounds of Syrah grapes. And we made our first batch of wine that year in 06. And then we installed our first vineyard later that year and have been just growing each year, getting a little more and more entrenched into the wine business.
More and more.
And Michael, you have your own vineyard installation business now. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I started that recently, and I'm just trying to grow the region, the Ramona Valley area, and got a lot of people interested in planting grapes and just... want to grow the region to make some great wine.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful growing environment up here. I understand that the Ramona Valley has its own AVA, which for our fans and listeners means American Viticulture Area. What's so special about Ramona?
Well, Ramona is unique, and I think when people drive up the hill to Ramona, they're surprised by the rocky outscapes. Mm-hmm. It almost looks like we're on another planet, and some people have told me it looks like the south of France. So it's ideal for growing grapes. Grapes were grown in San Diego County before Prohibition. It was a huge grape area. And grapes like the same things we do. They like hot days, cool evenings, a little breeze. So you add in Ramona's rocky soil, our south-facing slopes, and you have perfect growing conditions, which made us unique and recognized as an AVA.
I also understand that Ramona Ranch is also the co-owners of one of my favorite new little magazines, the Ramona Valley Wine Region magazine. When did this get launched?
That got launched like many great things, sitting around the table one Friday evening with a bunch of friends, drinking some good local wines, and we thought somebody needed to tell the story, so why not us as insiders and really starting out? We thought, well, let's do it. So we launched the magazine in 2011.
It's a good one too, folks.
Thanks. Our goal is to educate both the consumer and our growing trade. Mm-hmm. Ramona is a fairly new wine region. There's around 81 vineyards in Ramona right now.
Wow.
Like Mike said, more and more going in all the time. So we thought, well, there's a story here to tell. So we partnered with our friend Dave Billick, who has 30 years of publishing experience. And actually, the magazine was his idea. And we said, you know, you bring the publishing experience, we'll bring the vineyard and winery experience, and we're off and running. It's free online. It has the most up-to-date map of our region with 21 tasting rooms now up in and around Ramona.
What's the email address to that so people can check it out?
Yeah, it's free online. It's www.ramonavalleywineregion.com. And I encourage your listeners to check it out and let us know what they think.
With the new micro vineyard boutique winery ordinance passing, what can your guests expect, you know, when they come out to see you guys?
They can expect to meet the winemaker. This is the owners. And the joke around here is that Napa spills more wine than Ramona makes in a year. So it's very small, intimate.
So we also make extremely limited quantities. So usually only one barrel of each varietal. So when it's gone, it's gone. For our listeners, that's 24 cases of wine. So very small production.
Very nice.
And I use the analogy that boutique or artisan wines are similar to artisan breads that you might pick up at the farmer's market. Every batch is completely different. It's unique. It's made by hand. It's not mass produced. We don't use any machines in the making of our wines. So from the planting of the vines to the harvest and winemaking, we do everything by hand with extreme care to the quality. Great example is at our last harvest, we sorted 5,000 pounds of Sangiovese by hand, removing every shot berry or unripe berry, stems, leaves. We call it MOG, material other than grapes. You don't really want that in your wine at fermentation, and we're small enough to be able to sort through and pick every single one of those out.
Well, that's an awful lot of work for just two of you.
We round up all of our friends and we turn it into a party.
Life's a party at the vineyard for sure. One last question before we close here. Where can our listeners come to experience your wines?
We're open on Saturdays from noon to sunset, and details are available at the Ramona Valley Wine Region magazine or on our website, ramonaranch.net. We also are open on the occasional Sunday, although Mike and I still have full-time jobs during the week, so we try and take Sundays off, but we will open up on occasion or for private parties or by appointment. So I invite anyone who's interested in wine and the experience to take the time to come up to Ramona Valley. Again, there are currently 21 tasting rooms, and any one of us that you stop in can help you plan a special day in the country, and we're really just 35 minutes up the hill from San Diego.
It's beautiful up here. Come up and visit our good friends up in Ramona and come and visit the wine regions. Thanks so much for your time today. Hope everybody enjoyed meeting Michael and Terry.
Thanks, Greg, for coming up. We appreciate it.
You've been listening to Vines and Wines with Greg Maness, proprietor of the Maness Vineyards Estate.
Visit the website at manisvineyards.com.
An Amera Media production.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. The County Assessor Recorder wishes to advise all property owners whose property was damaged or destroyed in the Chariot Fire that property tax relief is available. This tax relief program requires the reassessment of the property to reflect the damaged condition. The reduced value will remain in effect until the property is rebuilt or repaired. After the property is rebuilt or repaired, owners can retain their previous taxable value if the property is rebuilt in a like manner. This means that the property tax assessment will not increase beyond what it was before the fire. This tax relief is available for any property damage, including homes, outbuildings, commercial and industrial properties, and mobile homes. Damage to vehicles and contents of a home, such as furniture, are not eligible for this tax relief. County Clerk Ernest Stronenberg says he is sympathetic with fire victims and strongly encourages all property owners who suffered fire damage to their property in excess of $10,000 to contact his office for the necessary claim form. You can get that by calling 619-531-4993 or visiting the Assessor Clerk's website at www.sdarcc.com. That's sdarcc.com. The assessor's office has already mailed information and claim forms to some affected property owners and will continue to do so as more information becomes available. For KNSJ and East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Rebecca Williamson bringing you an important agricultural report. A major threat to California's citrus industry has been found here in San Diego and in East County. Today, I'm here with East County Magazine editor Miriam Raftery. Miriam, tell us what's bugging state and local agricultural officials.
Officials are very worried that the Wong Bong Bling infestation, which sounds like a video game, but it's actually a very serious disease called citrus greening, could find its way into our region. Already, the bug that carries it, the Asian citrus psyllid, has been found in a number of areas, including El Cajon, Crest, Potrero, and other portions of East County. This is a bug, a disease, that killed 40% of Florida's citrus trees in just 1 year.
How can people tell if their citrus trees are infested?
The fruit can be discolored. It can have yellow blotches. Inside, it can be lopsided. And you can also notice discolored and curled leaves. And if you unroll one and you find a bug in there with red eyes looking at you, watch out.
Can it be cured?
Unfortunately, there is no cure for the disease. But fortunately, so far, we only have the insects here, not the disease, and officials are hoping to keep it that way. There are treatments, however, to kill the pest. A lot of them are ground treatments around your tree. They don't necessarily have to do spraying like some people are concerned about. So it's real important to get a hold of it early.
What should you do if you suspect that your citrus tree is harboring this pest?
Call the County Agriculture Department. There is some help. The state has given the county some money to deal with this problem. And you can also get information at www.eastcountymagazine.org. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Menashe, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.